Okay, we're beginning our learning together of Parshat Balak. Parshat Balak is an incredible parsha, is a beautiful parsha, and is a very complicated parsha, both internally, within the boundaries of Parshat Balak, in terms of what it is and what's happening, but also in terms of the narrative of Sefer Bamidbar. It's this very unique parsha that I don't think we see anywhere else in Torah, where we step away, seemingly, from the continuous narrative that's happening from the beginning of Bereshit all the way until Le'enei Kol Yisrael, at the end of Devarim. And this parsha just zooms out and sort of goes somewhere else. It tangents and takes a look at a story of nations looking at Kol Yisrael from the outside in, as opposed to experiencing what we're experiencing from the inside out. It's a whole nation talking about Kol Yisrael, trying to attack Klal Yisrael. And Klal Yisrael at the time seems to be ignorant of what's happening over the course of Parshat Balak. Do they even know? Assumably they know by the time, in a couple of Parshas' time, when they're told to go forth and kill Bilam. But maybe they don't know why they're killing Bilam then. It could even be that they don't even know about this until even farther along, when Moshe Rabbeinu himself turns to Klal Yisrael in Sefer Devarim and says how wonderful God is that he took all of the klalas of Bilam and turned them into brachot. Is that the first time they found out about it? I don't even know. So what was happening in the narrative so far? Not even going all the way back to the beginning. We had this intense moment in Parshat Shlach where we cracked open history, where instead of there being one fluid movement of leaving Eretz Mitzrayim and entering into Eretz Yisrael, seemingly a few days' journey, that's not going to be the case, that wasn't going to happen. And suddenly now we're divided into two halves. We have the Dor Yotzei Mitzrayim, the generation that leaves Mitzrayim, the generation of the Midbar. And then as we saw in the last parsha that we examined, Parshat Chukat, we fast forward 38 years and we see the rise of Dor Ba'e Ha'aretz, the generation that would enter into the land, the generation which didn't exist beforehand. There was no such defined generation. It was just going to be the people, the Jewish people, leaving Mitzrayim, going to Eretz Israel. Now suddenly you have the rise of Dor Ba'e Ha'aretz, a generation whose identity is that they are going to be the people who enter the land. Their name is different. Their essence is different, their identity is different, their challenges are different. Everything about them is going to be different than the Dor Yotzei Mitzrayim. It's not part of their definition. They are limited in their scope. They are distinctly the Dor Ba'e Ha'aretz. And therefore, when we meet them, after we've fast-forwarded for 38 years, we go through some of their challenges that define them in Parshat Chukat that we talked about last time, or two times ago. And then where do they end up at the end of Parshat Chukat? The last pasuk, we talked about it. What's the last pasuk of Parshat Chukat? Define it. Now it becomes important to actually know where we ended up. Arvot Moav al Yordan Yericho. We come to the border of Moav across the Jordan from Yericho. And we stay there, and that's where they're going to stay, because who are these people? They're the people who are going to enter the land. So they're going to spend the entirety of Chumash, where they exist, on the border, focusing on entering Eretz Yisrael, and then eventually going into Eretz Yisrael. But where do they actually land? What was the name of that place? Arvot Moav. And that seemingly is enough to justify now totally shifting gears and talking about Moav. How does this parsha link to the identity and the essence of Dor Ba'e Ha'aretz? How is it an extension of the narrative of leading us into Eretz Yisrael? How is it getting us there? What's the storyline here? There's sometimes like television shows, you have that, usually they're great episodes. Great episode where like they stop the main narrative and focus on a side character and then give you this whole story that's totally separate. That's usually a great episode, right? But the whole idea is that you're taking a step away from the main storyline. Torah's not going to do that. Torah's not going to step away from the main storyline. All there is Emmet. All there is the primary. There's no Tafel here. There's only Ikar. So how is this taking the narrative one step forward? How is this marching us one step forward toward our entrance into Eretz Yisrael? How is this helping that generation understand who they are? Keep that question in the back of your minds. We're not going to answer that question until Wednesday. Because before we can answer the larger narrative question, What do we need to do first? Smaller question, we have to understand the Parsha. We have to understand what's really at the core of the Parsha. Walking through, what are the main topics of the Parsha? What are the topics of Parshat Balak? Anyone? Take a look inside. Yeah?
How Balaam is just cursed the nation.
Good. How Balak hires Balaam to come and curse Bnei Israel. What else? Seems to be the same story. What else? That's the whole thing. Well, not exactly, because what happens at the end? Right, so we have some weird thing with... No, not Baal Peor.
With
the Benot Moav and Baal Peor, but we're going to focus on the Benot Moav part. But yes, you're correct. There seems to be some sort of sin that comes at the end, where we do make a mistake. There's terrible Znut in Klal Yisrael. We see the rise of Pinchas, which then leads into Parshat Pinchas. We're going to deal with that messiness next week. Definitely not there yet. But let's slice off even those last few psukim for now. The entire Parsha is the story of Balak and Bilam. So let's go through that story. At the beginning, Balak, again, now that we have Klal Yisrael, we just defeated Sichon and Og at the end of Parshat Chukat. And we've now landed on the border of Moab. They're freaking out. Balak is freaking out. We're next. So he decides we need to stop them. And how are we going to stop them? Says the king of Moab. The only way that I can imagine why, I don't know, we'll have to figure it out. The only way I can imagine stop them is to go and get somebody to curse out Klal Yisrael. That's going to be the answer. And so he goes to hire the person who is best suited to give Klalot. He goes to bring Bilam in. God very clearly indicates to Bilam that he should not be going. But like a man who wants to do something, when the other person's trying to hint to them not to do it, he totally misses it. Right? And he goes anyway, despite God continuously nudging him and kind of saying, don't go. By nudging, I also mean putting an angel with a sword in front of his face and making his donkey talk to him. Like, he just wants to go. He wants to go in the hopes that God might let him give a klala, and he might get the tremendous reward that Balak is offering him. They go to one place to go and curse Klal Yisrael. God takes that kala and turns it into a bracha. Balak says, stop, we'll go somewhere else. They go to a second place. Bilam goes to curse Klal Yisrael. God says, no, turns it into a bracha. Balak says, stop it. Take it to a third place. At that time, finally, Bilam goes, you know what? This is just not going to work. Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to give them brachot. And he opens himself up finally to give a bracha. And he gives a bracha to Klal Yisrael. It's the third bracha in this story. After that, Balak says, you stink at your job. You're the worst. To which Bilam goes, that's what I tried to tell you from the get-go. This is never going to work. So he says, get out of here. Go back home. Run with your tail between your legs. Get out of here. And Bilam says, whoa, before I go, I got one last thing to tell you. And he opens himself to this nevuah. He gives very oddly in the context of this parsha. He then gives a nevuah about what will happen between Bnei Israel and the nations in the end of days. That's the fourth nevuah. Then he goes back, end scene, and then we have this seemingly odd postscript of a few psukim dealing with the Benot Moav, the sinning with the Baal Peor and the Benot Moav, which we'll have to figure out how that fits into the story of Bilam and Balak. But that's the structure of the story. That's Parshat Balak in a nutshell. Now, how did you define a minute ago what this story was about? What were the words you used? Trying to curse Bnei Israel. And it's very clear that underneath the surface you're talking about going, you know, narrowing our scope before we explain, we try to figure out how this Parsha fits into Sefer Bamidbar. That very much at the heart and soul of this Parsha is the issue of and the tension between Bracha and Klala. What is Bracha? Can you curse Klal Yisrael? How do you curse Klal Yisrael? Why is Klal Yisrael Baruch? Why do they have this essence of Bracha? Why can't it be broken? Can it be broken at any point? But this tension between Bracha and Klal. It seems surprising coming out of nowhere But if we actually pay attention and think back to what the origins of this conflict are, things become a lot clearer. Where does the nation of Moab come from? Lot. Right there. Excellent. On target. Somebody was paying attention 2 weeks ago in Parshat Shavuot. Last week, Vayera. We're going to go back to Lechacha in a second. But last week in Vayera. No, because I'm thinking of Lot's already. No, we're going to go back to Lot's presence also in Parshat Lechacha 2 weeks ago. Parshat Lechacha. It's both. We'll do both. But we're going to focus on Parshat Lechacha. So if we go back to the origins of Moab, so the origins are found in Vayera by Lot, correct? What happens? It's a really tragic and horrifying story that when Lot sees the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, he and his daughters, seemingly, and Chazal are not so clear on who knew what and didn't know what, but Lot and his daughters seemingly assume that it's the end of the world. His daughters presume that the only way to keep the world going is to repopulate the world through their father. There's only one man and two women left. And they get their father drunk, and they have a relationship with him, and each one produces a son. And the first son that's born is Moav, which the Mefarshim bring out is Me'av, from my father. Emphasizing the kind of warped place that came from. And yet, still, as we talked about in Shir Kali, still somehow going to produce David HaMelech, and it needs to come from that kind of distorted and complex source. That's a whole shir for another time. So Moav is coming from Lot. If Moav is an expression of Lot, and Moav is coming to fight Klal Yisrael, if we're going to link back to those origin levels, who's going to take the other side of that fight? In the Bereshit way of being Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim, of paving the way for history, if we're seeing now a production over the course of history of this struggle between Moab and Bnei Yisrael, who is the struggle with on a Bereshit level? Between Lot and?
Avraham.
Between Lot and Avraham. That's the origin. That's the Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim level of what's now playing itself out generations later between Klal Yisrael and Moab. Yeah.
Are you saying that Bilam is from Moab?
Bilam is not from Moab. But Moab is coming specifically. Moab is afraid of Klal Yisrael, and Moab's instinctual reaction to fight Klal Yisrael is to find Bilam, because the only way that we are going to fight Klal Yisrael is on the level of Bracha and Klala. And that's a playing out of the struggle between Bracha and Klala of Avraham and Lot all the way from the beginning. Now, actually going back to Lech Lecha, for sure. Now I'm very confident, because it's the first pasuk of Lech Lecha. So if you go to source number on your sheet, or you want to open up in your Chumashim, to Bereshit Perek Yudbet, Pasuk Aleph, the beginning, 2 weeks ago, Parshat Lech Lecha. Watch how this is so much the essence of what Avraham is about, and his journey is about, from the very beginning. We don't always focus on this aspect of it, because there's so much to talk about in Lech Lecha. There's so much to talk about in the words Lech Lecha, that we don't always get farther. It's not on this particular, in this instance, it's not in a bad way. There's a lot to talk about in the words Lech Lecha. But look at the opening psukim. Vayomar Hashem al Avram. The first thing says to Avram, Lech Lecha, leave me'artzecha, u'milaratecha, u'mibet avicha, la'arat asher eka. Leave the land of your birthplace, of your father's household, to the land that I will show you. Parentheses, I wonder here, what are the two sides of the command here? To go and leave your father's household, and that's extrapolating. Simply pshat. What's the other half of the command? Which is, we know, Eretz Yisrael. And I wonder if that isn't showing us that ideally, just like Avram was supposed to be the one to leave behind his past and go into Eretz Yisrael, that the ideal again for Klal Yisrael was to leave Mitzrayim and to go into Eretz Yisrael in one fluid movement. I wonder if that wasn't even being hinted to in that very pasuk. But anyway, once he tells him to go out, then he says, "Ve'escha legoy gadol, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Ve'avarechecha, and I'm going to bless you. The Agadla Shemecha, and I'm going to make great your name. The Heye Bracha." What does the Heye Bracha mean? Somebody mumbled something, I missed it.
Excellent.
You will be a source of bracha. Say even more sharply in terms of the actual literal definition of the words here. The heyei bracha. Yeah. You will be bracha. Eliora corrects Eliora. You will be bracha. The heyei bracha. That's what Avraham's being told here. Your whole essence, your part of your identity is that you are bracha. That's who and what you are. The heyei bracha. Continues on. Or those who bless you will be blessed. And now we even see the flip side of that. And those who curse you, they will be cursed. And through you, the blessing for the entire world will come forth. These are the opening words to Avraham Avinu. Yes, Lech Lecha is there. But of these three psukim, two of them are obsessively focusing on the concept of bracha. It's part of the identity of Avraham. It's who and what he is. It's who the Jewish people are going to be. They are the bearers of bracha, the carriers of bracha. Assuming that's true, what is bracha? How do we define it? What does it mean that they're the carriers of bracha? So we've discussed this eons ago, in the beginning of Sefer Bereshit. Right, we're actually closer to the second cycle and we're going to start it again than we are to when we first taught it. But there are people in the room who maybe remember when we talked about bracha all the way in the beginning of Sefer Bereshit. Any nods of recognition? No. Yeah. I know who was in the room. You don't know who was in the room. Yeah, there were a few people who were in the room at the time. So let's go over, especially because most of us weren't there. What is this concept of bracha? What is bracha about? Bracha, we often translate as?
Blessing.
Right, we intentionally have avoided that word up until now. I haven't said that word, because that doesn't really mean anything. Just an awkward transliteration-ish of the word bracha. What is blessing? What does that mean? I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea what blessing means. But I'll tell you what bracha means. Bracha means it's always about riboy, increasing, multiplying, adding, bringing a greater amount into the world. See, it's an incredible Rashi. It's in your source sheets. Source number 2. A Rashi Masechet Sotah, where he actually defines what bracha is, and he says exactly what we said. Kol bracha shebe mikra, every single time that bracha is used in Tanakh, lashon riboy hu. It's all about riboy. It's all about increasing. That's what the letters of bracha indicate this as well. The letters Bet, Chaf, and Resh, which also are linked clearly to the concept of Bechor, which is why we talk about it in Sefer Bereshit. Clearly linked there, and that's where we'll talk about it next fall. And if you take the gematria of each one of these letters, what's a Bet? 2, Chaf, 20, Resh,
200,
right? All relating back to the number 2. They're all essentially linked to the number 2. What is the number 2 about? One is when there is just that thing. The number that goes into a reality of increasing, of showing that there's more, that there's going to be more, moving from a place of just being alone to a place of multitude, of multiple. That's the number 2. And so each one of the letters of the word itself indicate this movement into a reality of riboy. Bracha is also the root bet, resh chaf, is also related to the word brecha, a wellspring coming forth, producing waters. Interestingly enough, it's also related to the word birkaim, which means knees. Which, how does that fit into the conversation? And yet, when we dive into Shmona Esrei, what do we start off by doing? Bending our knees when we say what word?
Baruch.
We bend our knees when we say Baruch. Clearly, there's linkages happening there. But bracha is all about riboy, somehow. And those definitions have to link in as well. Bracha is all about ribui. We see this in a pasuk that we often quote in this context, for those who have been here before, in Tehillim, which we say in Hallel. Source number 3, Tehillim Kuf Tet Vav, pasuk Yudalid. Yosef Hashem Aleichem, Aleichem V'al Bneichem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will increase upon you and your children. He's going to create a reality of you for you, or a post-safa, of this increasing tremendously. And when you've reached that state of being in a state of being increased, how are we going to define you? Bruchim Atem LaHashem. That's when you're in a state of bracha. When you're in a state of Yosef, when you're in a state of having more, you're in a state of bracha. And as you travel through Chumash, every single time the concept of bracha comes up. It's always in the context of adding more. You even take a look at a place like the tremendous brachot in the beginning, I believe it's Parshat Ekev. In the beginning of Parshat Ekev, where we think of this beautiful brachot at the beginning of Ekev, but listen to how the brachot are phrased. If you listen to these mishpatim, ushmartem asitem otam, and you keep them, v'shamar Hashem elokecha lecha et habrit v'et hachesed shenishpal avotecha. Hear the words now. V'ahivcha, He will love you, uveirachecha, and He will give you blessings. So what's the next word? V'hirbecha, and therefore He will increase you. Uveirach, what's He giving bracha to? Privit necha, to have children. Upriad matzecha, the produce you're going to bring out. Digancha, v'tiyorshcha, v'yitzarcha, shgar lafecha, v'ashotzebecha, al ha'adama shenishpal avotecha latelach. Constantly talking about this explosion of having children and having produce in the fields of more and more and more, because bracha is increased, it's riboy. Baruch tiyem yikolim, you'll be more baruch than any other nation, which the second half of the pasuk defines as luya becha akar ve'akara uvivimtecha. What does that mean? Every single person will be able to produce children, and your animals will be able to produce more. This constant interplay of bracha and riboy. Everywhere. There's just one example, but every time, that's where it comes up. I didn't think of this before I was preparing Shir, but I think I caught it this year when I was reading Bereshit in Shnayim Mikra a few weeks ago. That, not surprisingly, then assuming that I might again, I didn't get a chance to double check this before Shir. What's the first bracha that God gives to the world and to man? Peruvu, which is to increase and bring forth more. The fact that all of you said it at the same time sounds good, like I'm on the right track. I think I just looked that up. I believe that that's how the phraseology is there in Bereshit as well. Bracha is all about ribui. And going back to Abraham, that's what he's told. You're going to be a great nation. You're going to just increase and increase and increase. That's what bracha is. Now the question then becomes, when does Avraham actually achieve a state of being mivorach? He's promised all of these things at the very opening of Lech Lecha. But when does Avraham actually achieve a state of being mivorach? So that's in source number 4, in Perek Yigimel Pasuk Zayin in Lech Lecha. Take a look. Pasuk Zayin. Vayhi Riv. Bein ro'e mikne Avram uvein ro'e mikne Lot. There was a machloket. There was an argument between who? The shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Lot. What was their argument?
The
what?
The grazing fields.
Was there wasn't enough room. It's not enough room. It's not enough room in this town for the both of us, they said to each other for the first time, which would later be co-opted, right? And so they have to split up. And that's how Lot ends up in stone. But now watch the phrasing of the pasuk. As we skip down, after they've decided to separate, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Yud Dalid, V'Hashem Amar El Avram, Acharehi Pared Lot Me'imo, and God says to Avram after Lot separates from him, Sanai Necha, Re'ei Mina Makom Asher Atasham, Safona V'Negba V'Kedma V'Yama, open up your eyes, and see from this place that you're at and look in all directions, north, south, east, and west. This whole land I'm going to give to you and to your children forever. I'm going to make your children like the dust of the earth. That if a person were only able to count the dust of the earth, then so too your children would be counted, but neither can be counted, because they're going to be so numerous, just like the dust of the earth. Promising this bracha, this reality of being increasing and increasing upon Avram Avinu. When does God make that promise? When does God tell him that? When do we switch gears?
After they separate.
After they separate. And not just after they separate, it's the exact pasuk. Those are the two halves of the same pasuk, pasuk yudalev. Look at it again. Then, once they've separated, Vashem Amar al Avram, God said to Avram, and then it qualifies it. Acharehi pared Lot mimo, only after Lot left. Lot needs to leave first, then Avram can exist in a state of bracha. Because while Avram is the carrier of bracha, Lot, and eventually his descendants, they're the carriers of Klala. And that comes back to Lot himself.
But Lot didn't necessarily have to leave. As in, like, they were fighting and Lot chose to leave. But wouldn't it have been, like, the same way we say, like, better for history if we hadn't done Latei Chayin Ram? Wouldn't it have been better for history if Lot and Abraham had been like, hey, we can work this out, and then they stuck together after all? No.
Not necessarily. Assumably not. Okay. Assumably not, but that's a longer and more complicated conversation. Yeah.
I once learned that Avram and Lot looked identical. The phrase in them said that Avram called him his brother.
I would love to see a source. I would love to see a source. If you could find a source from Chazal, I'm in. Yeah.
Also, if that's the case, and that kind of goes back to the question about the whole thing about how Mashiach is coming from Lot's descendants. So then, like, why is that a good thing if they carry
Klala? I don't want to get sidetracked onto that, but in terms of the conversation about where David comes from, I mean, the more and more and more one learns about the origins of David, the more and more the same question is intensified, which is, why did he have to come from such a dark and negative place? Why did he have to come from Lot? Why did he have to come from this place of curse? Why did he have to come from Lot and his daughters, which is totally problematic on so many levels, producing Moab? Why did he have to come through Rut, specifically, not that it's a bad thing, but specifically through a convert? Why did he have to come through the daughter of Yehuda and Tamar, where that whole relationship was very problematic, and he almost burned her at the stake for it? And then he did tshuva for what he did wrong, and then produces Peretz, who eventually get... So many questions on David. So many questions on David. But he clearly needs to be coming from a very different place. But it only strengthens that question, which, fortunately or unfortunately, is not our shir. But it's a very important topic, and it's something which people don't like to talk about, because it's uncomfortable. How do we deal with the fact that David is coming from such a negative place? And so we put the question on its head, like we normally do in these shirim, which is, clearly he must have come from a very dark and problematic place. But that's part of what he needs to be, and what he needs to accomplish, and what he needs to do. We have to figure out why that is, and what he does accomplish. Yeah?
Can you just explain again how low is Klala?
Because... didn't explain it yet.
Oh, he didn't.
That's exactly where we're at. So how is he cursed, says Rebecca? I'm not satisfied with just hearing the words, Lot is connected to curse. Give me something more than that. I'll give you a word. And that word is Lot, or Latye, or Lot, which is actually the word in Aramaic which appears consistently through the Gemara, which actually means curse. His name becomes the definition of curse. You could take a look at one example which was not picked for any specific reason in source number 12. Dilma kimilat Yoshua hachilat. When Yoshua went to curse, thus did he curse. Lot means to curse. It comes back to his very name. And then certainly plays out when we come down to Moab and the struggle with Klal Yisrael. And we see this struggle in Balak and Moab's emissary, in Bilam, and in the way that Bilam goes about attacking Klal Yisrael. Let's take a look at the content at this point, at the content of some of the things that Bilam actually says, and see how it relates in. for then. Yeah, we'll take the question, then we'll go forward.
Okay, but I just want to know, like, what do we know the context of how Lot was named?
We don't have on a Chumash level, we don't have that that clarity, no, unfortunately. Let's take a look at some Psukim by Bilam. Let's go to those brachot, well, rather klalot, that turn into brachot. Okay. Taking a look at the first bracha that comes forth from Bilam's mouth, Perek Chaf Gimel. It starts in Pasuk Zion. We'll just jump right into Pasuk Yud. It's also in source number 5 on your sheets, but you can take a look in your Chumashim, Perek, Chaf Gimel, Pasuk Yud. Bilam says, Mi mana far Yaakov, umispar et rova Yisrael. Who can count the dust of Yaakov and count even a quarter of Israel? Meaning, look at how mivorach they are. They're so numerous. They're so large. There's so much of them. There's so much riboy there. That's the bracha that he gives. Is reflecting the inherent bracha state of Klal Yisrael. But that wasn't what Bilam intended to say. Bilam tried to curse them. And the Gemara says something that helps us really understand where Bilam was coming from. Source number 6, Masechet Sanhedrin, tells us, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mibirchato Shaloto Rasha. From every bracha that Bilam, the Rasha, gave, Atalamar Mahaya Bilibo. From that, one can understand what was in his heart. So, what was Bilam's goal? What was he trying to do?
The opposite,
which was to limit them, which is what a klala is. To limit, to lessen, to withhold the Mivorach state of Klal Yisrael, to battle against the Mivorach state of Klal Yisrael. But because HaKadosh Baruch Hu flips it on its head, what comes out of his mouth is, Miman Afar Yaakov, who can count the dust of Yaakov? Or count even a quarter of Israel? And what does that sound like, by the way? The pasuk that we just read before from Parshat Lech Lecha. V'samti et zaracha ke'afar ha'aretz, or imyuchal ish limnot et afar ha'aretz, gam zaracha yimaneh. He's reflecting that bracha state of Klal Yisrael that God gave to Avram Avinu. So when the bracha comes out of Bilam's mouth, it's almost the same words. Reflecting that mivorach state of Klal Yisrael. Going forward. Taking a look at another amazing Gemara that talks about what bracha is about. And then watching how Bilam is struggling with this whole reality. That there's a reality by bracha, brought down in source number 7 on your sheets in Masechet Ta'anit. The Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Ein ha bracha mitzuya, ela badavar hasamoy min ha'ayin. That bracha is only found in a place that's hidden away from the eye. If you can see it, then it can't have a reality of bracha. If it's hidden from the eye, then it could be a seitan bracha. Going forward, a similar, almost parallel line. Tana Devei Rabbi Yishmael, the second underline. Ein ha-bracha mitzuya ela badavar she'ein ha'ayin sholetet bo. Bracha can only exist in a reality where the eye is not ruling over that place. Because what happens when I look at something? What happens when I go to count something? What am I doing? I'm quantifying it, I'm looking at it, I'm limiting it. I'm giving it a fixed reality in this world. I'm taking away the potential for riboy. When I look at something, I'm sizing it up, right? That's how it's phrased, used even in English. I'm defining what it is. I'm giving it its borders and its boundaries. There's no more room for riboy. So the Gemara then goes on to say that back in the day when they used to go and they wanted to see how much grain they had accumulated. So they would go to the silos. And before they would go in, they would say this beautiful bracha about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bless, should be mevarech what's inside of those the grain that they have, that they own. Says the Gemara. Person goes and says that bracha and that tefillah before they go and count their grain, wonderful. But if a person goes and looks at that grain and then says the bracha, last underline in the Gemara, madad, a person who measures out the grain first, v'acharkach berach, and then says the bracha, harezet tefilat shav. It's a worthless bracha. It's a nothing. It's a worthless bracha. Why? Lefin she'ena bracha mitzuya lo b'davar shakul v'lo b'davar hamadud v'lo b'davar hamanoi. Because bracha can't go on something that's already been weighed out or measured or counted out. Ela b'davar hasamor mina'ayin. Once I've looked at it, once I've quantified it, there's no longer bracha involved. Taking that into account, when I was looking at these psukim over the summer, it opened up my eyes to the tremendous bracha that's in the parsha. Watch how the parsha plays out. Suddenly, psukim start to light up. At this point, my Rebbe had kind of finished giving over his piece, the short piece that he had on the shiur, and I was just reading through the psukim, and it just everything started to light up. So watch what happens. Sources number 8, 9, and 10 on your sheet, in your chumashim, I think it's even more powerful to look at it in your chumashim, to follow along, read off where we're reading from. That this is the beginning of every stage of when Bilam goes to give another klala that turns into a bracha to klal Yisrael. First, source number 8. Perek chavbet pasuk lamitet. Vayelach bilamim balak vayavo kiryat chutzot. So they go to give the first klala. Vayizbach balak bakar v'chule, next pasuk. Vayhi baboker vayikach balak et bilam vayaleu b'makom. Sorry, b'mot ba'al. Vayar misham. What's the end of that pasuk? Say ha'am. Where did he go? What did he want to go to see? Just a little bit of Klal Yisrael. To limit them. To try to only look at a part of them. To make them fixed, finite. To take away their bracha state in order that a klala could be shoreh on them. That a klala could land on them. And it doesn't work. A bracha comes anyway. So look at the reaction of Balak. And the reaction of Bilam, when that happens, which to me is the most powerful pasuk of the three in sources 8, 9, and 10. Perek chaf gimel pasuk yud gimel. Vayomer elav Balak. When it doesn't work, so Balak says to Bilam, Lechana, let us go forth. Lechana iti, come and come with me. El makom acher, to a different place. Tirena misham, where we can go and look at them from a different place. Efes katsehu tireh. Vichulo lo tireh. The Kavnoli Misham. There, Efes Katseh, you won't even see a Katseh. Almost the end of nothingness, just a little part of Klal Yisrael. And don't worry, emphasizing it on the flip side. And you definitely won't see the whole thing, and from there you'll be able to bring a Klala. Ever wonder that? Why it is that they think if they keep hopping from mountaintop to mountaintop, then suddenly the Klala is going to work? But it's why they're moving from mountaintop to mountaintop. They keep moving from place to place to place to try and find an angle at which only a limited amount of Klal Yisrael can be seen and counted and defined and fixed, and therefore removing a reality of bracha and allowing for Klala to come into the equation.
Well, I thought you said that if you look at everything, then the bracha would be nullified.
That's what he's trying to do. Well, no, so if he looks at this endlessness of Klal Yisrael, so he's embracing the riboy of Klal Yisrael. He's trying to look at only a small portion of them that are cut off, and maybe through there find a gateway to bring in bracha, to bring in Klala.
How would that work? Why?
Because he's limiting them. He's looking at a finite portion of them. He's trying to limit, whittle down Klal Yisrael to a reality where bracha can enter into the equation. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And when he does try to look at the whole of Klal Yisrael, watch what happens. We have that also. That's now we move on to the third time that he tries to give a klala to Bnei Yisrael, but at this point he says, you know what? It's just going to be a bracha. And watch the words. Watch the words.
Wait, why doesn't it work? I don't understand why.
Because God is protecting us. Because God won't let him curse us. Because we are a reality of bracha. V'heyei bracha.
So why do we have to take extra measures?
Foreshadowing. Unless we break our reality of bracha. And maybe that's why things break down at the end of the parsha. Mm-hmm. We'll get there on either Wednesday or next Monday. Let's wait till we get there. But for now, watch this and watch the next pasukim. Perek Chavdalet Pasuk Aleph. Bilam now embraces the fact that he's going to give a bracha to Klal Yisrael. Vayar Bilam. Bilam sees. He opens his eyes to the reality of what's happening. Watch all of these sight-oriented words. Vayar Bilam, ki tov be'enei Hashem, that it's good in the eyes of God, specifically in the name of God, Yud Kei Vav Kei, that's indicative of Hayahu Ve'viyeh, an infinite God, who is the infinite source of infinite bracha. Vayar Bilam, ki tov be'enei Hashem, that it's good in the eyes of Yud Kei Vav Kei, livarech et Yisrael, for him to share that infinite bracha with Klal Yisrael. V'lo halach kifa'am b'fa'am likrat nechashim. And he didn't try to go through any other means. V'yashet el hamidbar panav. And so he turns his face, Shira, he turns his face to the entirety of the desert and looks out at that vastness of Klal Yisrael and the vastness of that desert. Not limiting them. You can't see that whole thing at once. Not limiting them, but looking out at their vastness, at their riboy, and embracing that finally. So then he lifts up again, lifts up his eyes, opens himself up to the bracha that's out there to see what the real reality of Klal Yisrael is. Not to try to limit his vision of them, but opening himself to recognizing that he can't see the infinite nature of Klal Yisrael. Vayar Yisrael shochein lishvatav, and he sees them sitting according to their shvatim. Vatihi alav ruach elokim, and the ruach elokim comes upon him. Vayisamish lo vayomar, and he begins his parable and says, Neum Bilam beno Beor. So says Bilam the son of Beor. Neum hagever shetum ha'ayin. So says the person with the uncovered eye. He's able to see now. He's able to have a deeper vision of what Klal Yisrael is. Ne'um shomea imrekel asher machazeh shakaita yechazeh, who sees the visions of Shakai, nofel glui naim, who's fallen and whose eyes are uncovered. Matovu alecha Yaakov mishmatecha Yisrael. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that on Wednesday. That key pasuk that clearly plays a central role to who we are. But look at all of these words about opening himself up to the vastness. To opening his eyes to what's really out there, not trying to limit his vision to seeing just a little bit of Klal Yisrael, but embracing the vastness and the mevorach seed of Klal Yisrael, the infinite nature of Klal Yisrael. Finally being able to see them for who and what they really are. I'm going to stop here. We're going to stop here. What we've covered today is understanding that just in the Parsha itself, the Parsha of Parshat Balak, that the tension that's existing here is the tension between Bnei Yisrael and Moav, which is a playing out of what we saw on a Maaseh Avot Siman Levanim level of the struggle between Avraham and Lot, that Avraham and his children are going to be the bearers of bracha, of riboy in the world, of bringing the infinite shefa of HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the world. They're the ones who are going to do that. Lot, milashon latye. Lot is relating to curse. His children in Moab are looking then to combat Klal Yisrael. And so they do that through seeking out he who is all about curse, Bilam, and constantly trying to limit them, to define them, to look at them in a way where they can bring them down to a certain level, to bring out a reality where they can be cursed. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu won't let that happen. HaKadosh Baruch Hu won't let that happen to His people. His people He defined. We are the people. We are the people of bracha. Klal Yisrael are the people of bracha. All of you as part of Klal Yisrael are the bearers of bracha. That's part of our identity. It's part of who we are. And unless we do something to break that reality of bracha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is defending us and maintaining that reality of bracha even amongst the conflict with other nations of the world like Moav, who try to bring a reality of klala to us. And even going so far as to transform that klala to a bracha. That's inherently what's underlying Parshat Balak, is the struggle between bracha and klala, between Avram and Lot, between Klal Yisrael and Moav. What we're going to shift gears into on Wednesday is, well, if that's what Parshat Balak is about, how does that fit into the narrative of Bamidbar? Why is that here? Why is this a topic that needs to be discussed in the context of the Dor Ba'ei Ha'aretz? And what does that mean about Klal Yisrael's interaction with Moav and, foreshadowing, all the nations of the world going forward? So we'll pick up there, B'ezrat Hashem, on Wednesday.